Let me start with some questions about Barack Obama's decision to go after Osama bin Laden. You mentioned that the methods that he used with his military planners and intelligence officers was that they were asked to make probabilities as to certain, or make predictions of, and the likelihood of those predictions being accurate. And you said that the predictions were all over the map, between 25 and 95% that in fact Osama bin Laden was in that fortress. And that you said it was probably correct for Barack Obama to give it little credence, and that he decided it was probably just 50-50. It seems to me that you don't particularly like the nature of the question, which is put an estimate on probabilities. What should Barack Obama have asked if he had not asked about the probabilities? Or was it valuable to ask the probabilities, find out that the distribution was all over the map so that he knew that, that I guess the distribution around those probabilities was quite wide. In other words, there was a large standard deviation around those respective means. Go ahead, John.
I think what he should have asked was, tell me a story. And there are various stories which he should have been asking for. How reliable are these spy satellite photographs? What's the basis on which people have made these kind of estimates? If I order the raid, there are a lot of things that can go wrong. What are they? And how will we extricate themselves from them if we can? That's what we mean by saying people naturally don't think in terms of probabilities. They think in terms of stories, narratives. They think in terms of what can go wrong with these kind of narratives. And that's the way over thousands of years, essentially, people have found as ways of coping with uncertainty. And the key thing is to build a strategy that is robust and resilient to the kind of things you don't know. So there were a lot of these uncertainties about the raid on Pakistan. Equally, if one compares the raid of the compound with a failed operation in the desert in 1979, when Carter ordered the operation to get the hostages out. What was wrong with that was that the plan to achieve that was not robust and resilient to the things that actually went wrong when the people were on the ground and, in Iran.
Just going back to the... I'll call it the Iranian fiasco with Jimmy Carter. In Charlie Beckwith's book on Delta Force, he talks about that invasion I call it hostage freeing proposal. And he had made the decision that if a certain number of helicopters were inoperable, that he would cancel the mission. And as I understand it, when the number of helicopters were destroyed on the ground, Carter may have suggested to continue going on, but Beckwith pretended he couldn't understand the president and ordered the operation to be terminated. When we think about things, sometimes do go wrong, and you know, maybe the plan wasn't robust and resilient enough, but oftentimes bad things happen. It could have been, for example, that Osama bin Laden was not in that compound, and it could have been the fact that enough of the helicopters wouldn't have broken and would have continued on to Tehran. Whether successful or not, I don't know. But how do we think about, just because we only have one draw, whether one should be a success and one should be a failure in terms of operational success or good planning and good execution?
It's a good question. And the decision wasn't right because bin Laden was actually killed, and the decision wasn't wrong because the Iranian hostage mission failed. It's what there's a professional poker player called Annie Duke who's written an interesting book on some of these subjects, and she talks about this as resulting. It's the idea that you decide whether a decision was good or bad by whether it worked well or not. And if you're going to play poker well, you have to understand that you can't do resulting. So it can be that things go wrong, and what was with foresight a good decision turns out to be with hindsight a bad decision. And we have to learn to cope with these things. But the only way we can cope with them is by trying to find strategies that are robust and resilient. So in both the bin Laden case and the Iranian hostage case, you could be pretty confident that some things were going to go wrong. It turned out in the hostage case that the strategy wasn't robust enough to actually achieve its goals. I don't know what if we would have been involved in making it robust enough. And probably, we can certainly criticize people for not having made it robust in that kind of way. Equally, in the Obama case, a lot of things might have gone wrong, but didn't. And in that case, we might very well have, we'd certainly have a different view of the raid. We might have a very different view of Obama as president. We can't simply judge decisions by looking with hindsight as to whether they worked out or whether they didn't work out. But if one goes back to something like the financial crisis, we can have a pretty good idea as to whether people in the financial sector have a good track record of, on balance, getting things right or too frequently getting things wrong. And that's very different. It's relying on judgment and experience at the expense of predictive modeling.
Last week on What Happens Next, we discussed GameStop and the crazy market behavior that existed in that stock over the last few weeks. A number of market makers had sold options at relatively low implied volatilities and then lost a fortune when, in fact, the realized volatility over the last few weeks it was astronomical. What did those traders make a fundamental mistake in their misunderstanding of the non-stationary aspects of volatility? Or was it just a bad draw where there was something completely out of the ordinary that they either could have recognized, should have recognized, or something that, look, it's such a remote draw, you know, these are the times when you lose the money. How do you think about being a market maker and trying to figure out what the future will hold as it relates to options or something else?
I think it was both these things. That actually part of the problem was believing that you could derive estimates of current volatility from observation of volatility in the past. And the market conditions we've seen in the last year or two are ones where it's very clear that that assumption is false. There's also an element of just making a bad draw. If you're going to have short positions, sometimes something is going wrong, it's going to go wrong. But also, if you're taking out large short positions, you need robustness and resilience means you need to have some kind of exit strategy. And one of the things I think we've learned about short selling is it's quite difficult to have robust and resilient exit strategies when something starts to go wrong for you. And I think we'll learn more about it in a few months when everyone can take a cooler view on it. But I think short sellers will have to do a lot more thinking about effective exit strategies than they've clearly done in the past. I've been looking back actually on Europe's biggest example of that kind of thing, which was a few years ago when there was a similar short squeeze in Volkswagen.
Oh yeah.
And for a time, Volkswagen was actually the most valuable company in the world as shorts were squeezed out. I think anyone who's ever shorted markets knows that it's you need pretty strong nerves to stay in these positions.
In the example you gave with the card playing, what you have is a deck of cards that is a stationary distribution. But in warfare, that isn't the case. You've got two parties without any rules, going, you know, going full at it, but you still have to make a decision, just like Barack Obama had to make a decision. And when you look at some of the great military decisions where the other side can undermine it, take D-Day for example. How do you think about that sort of decision in the context of uncertainty with regards to, let's say, weather, technology, and the response of the Germans?
Right. So you have a whole variety of unknowns in that. And there are a whole variety of devices which were put in place to try and make D-Day work. One of the great achievements was the selling of misinformation to the Germans so that they were not sure, even at the last minute, with a huge build-up of forces on the English coast, where the landing was actually going to be. You needed, and I certainly don't know very much about them and not very much maybe known about them, but there had to be exit strategies. What was Eisenhower going to do if things turned out to be much worse than the central plan anticipated? And also, of course, the weather was a big deal, and we know that the planners put a lot of reliance on weather forecasting, which is one of these things that has a relatively stationary process, which means we can do it quite well. And they adjusted the timing of the D-Day landings to give them the best chance of making these successful. It's interesting because weather forecasting is a good example of a stationary process where we can make predictions, although we have a lot of questions about what these predictions are. I've asked myself the question, indeed we spend a little time on this in the book, on the question of when the app on your phone tells you there's a 40% chance of rain tomorrow, what does that actually mean? And what is that number actually based on? And we lost a bit of confidence in it all by going through these inquiries.
Let me try a more basic question. You reference Frank Knight's distinction between risk and uncertainty. I just wanted you to maybe articulate what that difference was for the benefit of the audience who hasn't read the book.
Yeah, for Frank Knight, it was the difference. Risk was what you could describe probabilistically. Uncertainty was what you could not describe with probabilities. And Keynes essentially made the same distinction in his book in the same year. We actually make that distinction rather differently. And we describe resolvable uncertainty as uncertainty that you can describe probabilistically, and radical uncertainty as uncertainty which you can't. What we mean by radical uncertainty is not knowing, mostly it's not knowing what is going to happen, although it can also be not knowing what is happening, as in the Obama case. You don't know whether the man in the compound is bin Laden or not. So uncertainty comes from imperfect information. And you can resolve that in one or two ways. One is you can go out and get more information. The other is you can say there's a stationary distribution and we can therefore construct a probability distribution. Radical uncertainty is where you can't do either of these things, which is pretty often. And as we've kept emphasizing this conversation, even where there's radical uncertainty, you typically do actually have to make decisions.
You know, Dodd-Frank requires that banks prepare for, I'll call it, catastrophic events, what they're going to do. And somehow this is going to give reassurance to the regulators as to the plans of a living will for these institutions. When you hear about this approach to minimizing the damage of another financial crisis, do you think this is a wise idea? Do you give it any credence? Or does it give another false sense of hope that this is something that will add value in the process?
I give it some credence. Since the 2008 crisis, we've raised minimum capital requirements quite a bit. And we've also required people to go in for these stress tests and to construct the living worlds you describe. But we haven't, to be honest, changed very much. And capital requirements are higher than they used to be, but they're not so much higher. And one of the things we've learned looking back on the 2008 crisis was how much capital they had was almost useless as a predictor of what how severe the financial crisis would be. We mentioned earlier in the call, actually, Northern Rock, which was literally announced itself to be the best capitalized bank in Britain, and according to the regulatory rules was, and it announced that essentially 6 months before it went bust.
That being said,
and we're still using models not very different.
That said, when you have such a complicated world, if someone said to me, what design would you have to improve the efficacy of the banking system, I would just simplify the problem just saying, put more capital in, and then you can not rely so much on these, I'll call it bogus models to rely on. Those same models that you poke fun at David Vanier for.
Yep, that's right. Right. What robustness and resilience, and we emphasize again and again robustness and resilience. And in complex engineering systems, robustness and resilience typically means modularity and redundancy. Modularity means you design systems such that if parts of it fail, that doesn't mean the system as a whole fails. Redundancy means you don't build things to the tolerances you think you might be able to get away with. You build things to accommodate a storm worse than has ever been experienced, and so on. And that's really important because in the financial system up to the financial crisis, both redundancy, but both modularity and redundancy were regarded as measures of inefficiency. If banks had more capital than the regulatory requirements obliged them to have, we called that surplus capital. Modularity meant siloing different activities into ideally different firms or certainly different parts of firms, so that if the investment banking part of a aspects of investment banking failed, that didn't jeopardize retail banking. One of the main things about the deregulation of the 70s and 80s was that it removed these silos. And at the same time, having more capital than the regulation demanded was regarded as surplus capital, and you were inefficient unless you distributed it back to shareholders. Now, that's been a lesson for many other firms in the recent pandemic, that again, they'd reduced modularity and built just-in-time supply chains, and that meant they didn't necessarily have the robustness and resilience to cope well with the crisis.
Donald Rumsfeld, in a famous speech, discussed the unknown unknowns. And for you, that is a key aspect of uncertainty. So not only is it a non-stationary, but we don't even know what we're talking about. What is your comment or the insight that Rumsfeld has, and how should policymakers, or for that matter, investors, think about the unknown unknowns as it relates to their evaluation of events?
It's interesting, in Rumsfeld terms, unknown unknowns are the things we don't know, we don't know. And we were rather interested to trace the history of that remark, because it turns out Rumsfeld got it from Boeing. And Boeing engineers talked about unknowns, by which they meant unknown unknowns. And that happened in the 1950s, when the reason America took over from Britain in leadership in civil jet aviation, because the first jet airliners that flew were actually British planes. But there were two disastrous crashes of these British planes in 1952 and 1953. And it took people a long time to work out what the source of the problem was. And it was paradoxically simple. It was that you couldn't have square windows in planes because stress is built up round the corners of the square, which actually produced metal fatigue in the aircraft frame. And that's why, if you look, all planes nowadays have oval windows rather than square windows. But this was the unknown unknowns. And Boeing engineers from then on knew they had to keep looking for unknown unknowns, trying to build planes that were robust and resilient enough to cope with things they couldn't predict. I think we might infer that Boeing perhaps forgot that lesson in the last decade, and that's evident in the current problems they have with 737 MAX.
Or does that mean that you can never get around the unknown unknowns, no matter how much estimates you make? John, we're going to... John, thank you very much.